Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're really getting into positional volatility trading using options.
Yeah, exactly. So we're not talking about that super high frequency stuff.
No, this is more about trades you might hold for days, maybe even months. It's all about, understanding volatility's ebb and flow and potentially finding opportunities there.
Right. And our mission here is basically to boil down the key insights for you.
We've looked at a whole range of material, haven't we? Academic stuff, practical trading perspective.
Absolutely. We've tried to distill it all, pull out that actionable knowledge. We want to move past just the textbook theory.
Get into the real world side of things, how it works, what can go right, and maybe more importantly, what the pitfalls are.
Exactly. The hidden dangers.
Yeah.
Trading volatility isn't simple.
Okay, so where do we start? Maybe with the basic philosophy. The source material really stressed how vital a trading philosophy is. It's kind of like deciding if you're a value or growth investor in stocks, isn't it?
That's a great analogy. You really do need a framework, a plan. You can't just wing it.
And it's interesting, this resistance some traditional option traders seem to have towards quantitative techniques.
Yeah, it's a bit like, back in baseball, everyone got batting average, but when newer stats came along.
Right, there was skepticism, sabermetrics, and all that.
Exactly. But the interesting thing is, the source points out many of those same traders are quite comfortable using Black-Scholes-Merton, or BSM, and implied volatility.
Yeah, it's like there's a line drawn somewhere. Old quant is okay, new quant is suspicious.
Sort of. But here's a key takeaway. The market itself, or at least how options get priced, often behaves as if Black-Scholes is the benchmark.
So even if you think the model's flawed, you need to understand it, to trade against it effectively.
Precisely. You need to know the rules before you can break them, so to speak.
Okay, let's dig into Black-Scholes-Merton then. The material makes a good point. Just knowing the standard formulas doesn't automatically tell you how to profit.
No, it doesn't. It's like having a list of ingredients, but no recipe, or maybe no feel for cooking.
So how do we get that feel for trading with it?
Well, one approach suggested is to think about it from the perspective of a delta hedge portfolio.
Okay, explain that a bit.
So imagine you combine, say, a call option with a short position in the actual stock. Delta hedging means you're trying to balance it, so small moves in the stock price don't immediately cause you profit or loss.
You're neutralizing the directional risk, at least for small moves.
Exactly. And by analyzing how that specific portfolio changes value over time, considering factors like volatility and time decay, you can actually derive the BSM equation. It links the theory directly to a practical trading setup.
And you mentioned Delta there. That's the option's sensitivity to the stock price moving.
Right. How much the option price changes for a $1 move in the underlying. Hedging that delta is fundamental.
We also need to factor in dividends, don't we?
Oh, absolutely crucial. Options don't pay dividends. So when a stock pays one, its price drops, which hurts call options and helps put options. BSM accounts for this.
And the idea of hedging direction isn't new, is it? Traders were doing this sort of thing even before Black-Scholes and Merton formalized it.
That's right. They were combining options and stock to manage risk. BSM gave it a rigorous mathematical foundation.
Okay, let's shift gears. Measuring volatility. This seems way trickier than just looking up a stock
It
price.
really is
Yeah.
because, well, you can't just see volatility directly on a screen like a price. It has to be estimated, inferred.
And the challenge is.
The core challenge is separating the signal from the noise. Black-Scholes assumes returns follow a nice, neat, normal distribution, and volatility, or variance technically, tells you how wide that distribution is.
But real returns aren't perfectly normal, are they?
Not at all. But volatility is still our main handle on understanding how much prices might swing. A big difficulty, though, is statistically distinguishing the average return, the drift, from the variance around it.
The source mentions the simplest estimator, close-to-close volatility, just using the closing prices, but it says it's inefficient.
Yeah, very inefficient. Because think about it, it completely ignores everything that happened between yesterday's close and today's close. All that intraday price action, gone.
So it could miss a really volatile day if the price happens to close near where it opened.
Exactly. And it converges really slowly to the true volatility. Your estimate might lag way behind what's actually happening.
Okay, so that leads to better estimators, like the Parkinson one, using the high and low for the day.
Right. The Parkinson estimator brings in the daily high and low. That range gives you a much better snapshot of the day's price movement, the actual realized volatility for that period.
And it's more efficient.
significantly more efficient, yes. The research shows it converges much faster.
Yeah.
So for you as a positional trader, maybe less worried about the exact close, but more about the day's overall swing, Parkinson can be a much better signal.
The material also mentions first exit times. That sounds complex. And there's a figure showing the distribution of volatility estimates using close to close, highlighting the uncertainty.
Yeah, figure 2.5 really drives home how unstable that close to close estimate can be. Parkinson is generally better sensible use of the daily range, faster convergence.
But it has a downside.
It does. It assumes no sudden price jumps during the trading day, which, you know, isn't always realistic. Think flash crashes or big news events.
What about using high frequency data? Ticks or minutes instead of days?
Well, the upside is obvious. Lots more data points. That means your estimate converges very quickly, and it's less sensitive to any single weird price point.
The downside being?
You need the data. Accessing and processing high-frequency data isn't trivial. And you have to ask, for a positional trade held over weeks, do you really need tick-level volatility estimates? Maybe not.
So is there a best estimator then?
But that's the key insight from the source, is probably not. There's no single silver bullet.
It depends on what you're trying to learn.
Exactly. What question are you asking? For instance, if your Parkinson estimate is way higher than your close-to-close estimate for the same period.
Ah, that tells you most of the volatility was happening during the trading day, not necessarily reflected in the closing price change.
Precisely. And that difference could be really important for how you decide to hedge or what kind of volatility you're trying to capture. The source even mentions predictable patterns in this difference for things like ADRs due to overnight information flow.
There's also mention of adjusting for opening jumps in high frequency data.
Right, because a lot can happen overnight between the close and the next open. Especially with high frequency intraday data, you need to account for that opening gap. Otherwise, you're missing a potentially big chunk of the volatility picture.
And the source gives some typical percentages for how much volatility happens during the main trading session for stocks, indices.
Yeah, it varies by asset class, but it shows that overnight or gap risk is significant.
Okay, what about this trade-off? Using lots of data over a short time versus less frequent data over a long time.
That's an interesting one. You might think more data is always better, right? High frequency data should win.
Seems intuitive.
But some research suggests that for forecasting volatility further out, using lower frequency data, like daily data, over a longer history, might actually give you a better prediction of future high frequency volatility.
Huh. That's counterintuitive.
It is a bit. It suggests that maybe the longer term trends in daily volatility have more predictive power for the future regime than just the very recent intraday noise.
So the conclusion is, volatility measurement is tricky. Something of an art, as the source puts it.
That sums it up nicely. It requires judgment. Now let's talk about the stylized facts of market returns and volatility.
Stylized facts, these are like the common patterns we see over and over again in financial data.
Exactly. Think of them as statistical tendencies, not absolute laws, but patterns that show up pretty consistently across different markets and time periods.
And one of the biggest is volatility clustering, right? The idea that volatility isn't random day to day.
Right. High volatility tends to be followed by more high volatility, and low periods tend to persist too. Figures 3.3 and 3.4 in the source material show this visually with autocorrelations. It's like volatility has inertia or momentum.
So if you've just had a really volatile week, the odds are the next week might be pretty volatile too.
Generally, yes. That's the clustering effect. And that's a key insight for trading, isn't it? If volatility clusters, maybe you adjust your trade size or how aggressively you hedge based on the recent environment.
Makes sense. Expect the current regime to continue, at least for a while.
But this clustering isn't the same everywhere, is it?
No, the source notes differences. Developed markets might show it more strongly than emerging markets, and bear markets often have really strong clustering.
Until they don't. Like in a full-blown panic or crash, sometimes those correlations can break down fast.
Okay, so clustering is one thing. What's another key stylized fact?
I mean reversion of volatility.
Ah, so while it clusters in the short term, it doesn't just keep going up or down forever.
Exactly. It tends to eventually revert back towards some kind of long-term average level. If volatility spikes way up, the odds favor it coming back down eventually. And if it gets unusually low, it probably won't stay there forever either.
The source mentions the variance ratio test for this and shows VIX data at different frequencies.
Yeah, figures 3.5 and 3.6 illustrate it well. You see that volatility measured over longer horizons tends to be smoother and lower than short-term volatility. That's mean reversion at work.
So combining those two, volatility clusters, but it also means reverts. That interplay seems crucial.
Absolutely fundamental for anyone trading volatility. You're constantly balancing those two tendencies.
Another stylized fact. Returns aren't normally distributed. We hear this a lot.
Right. The bell curve is a nice starting point, but reality is messier. Financial returns typically have negative skew.
Meaning big downward moves are more common or larger than big upward moves.
Kind of, yeah. The left tail is fatter or longer than the right tail. And related to that, they have fat tails in general, or excess kurtosis.
Fat tails, meaning extreme events, big up or down moves, happen much more often than a normal distribution would predict.
Precisely. Mills noticed this way back. The table in the source, showing kurtosis levels for different assets, really drives this home.
And surprisingly, a lot of this fat-tailedness in stocks comes from the overnight gaps.
Yeah, table 3.2 highlights that. A lot of the really big moves happen between the close and the next open. Figures 3.10 and 3.11 also show the S&P 500 volatility distribution, emphasizing those fatter tails, especially during bear markets.
So the key risk management insight is, don't rely on models assuming normality, because extreme events are more likely than you might think.
Definitely. Okay, so this begs a question. We always hear that predicting stock prices or returns is incredibly hard, maybe impossible consistently. Why should volatility be any more predictable?
Good question. The source hints that maybe option markets aren't perfectly efficient in processing volatility information. It mentions prices taking weeks to react sometimes.
That's part of it. But also, volatility itself just has more structure than price direction. Those stylized facts we just talked about, clustering and mean reversion, give volatility statistical properties that make it inherently more forecastable than the underlying price, which behaves much more like a random walk.
So even if you can't predict if the stock will go up or down, you might have a better shot at predicting how much it's likely to move.
Exactly. As the deep dive puts it, volatility is far more predictable than price. And that predictability is where the potential edge lies for a volatility trader.
Okay, so if we accept that volatility is somewhat predictable, how do we go about forecasting it?
Well, the simplest thing is just to use the most recent measurement, right? Yesterday's volatility predicts today's.
But the source says that's not great because of mean reversion.
Right. If volatility just spiked, simply using that high number ignores the tendency for it to come back down. That leads to things like the exponentially weighted moving average, EWMA.
How does EWMA work?
It's a moving average, but it gives more weight to recent data points and less to older ones. So it reacts faster than a simple average.
But the drawback is,
it still fundamentally ignores mean reversion. It will follow a trend up or down, but it doesn't have that built-in tendency to pull back towards a long-term average.
Okay, so that brings us to models like GAR-CH.
Exactly. The GAR-CH family, generalized autoregressive conditional heteroscedasticity. Quite a mouthful.
Let's just stick with GAR-CH. What's the key improvement?
The big thing GAR-CH models add is that explicit long-term average variance level.
Oh.
So the forecast it produces will incorporate both a recent volatility, like EWMA, and a pullback towards that long-run average.
So it captures both clustering and mean reversion.
It tries to, yes.
Yeah.
Equations 4.8 and 4.9 show the basic GAR-CH 11 model structure, and figure 4.2 shows how a GAR-CH model can predict a whole-term structure of volatility forecasts for 1 week out, 1 month out, etc., showing that reversion effect over time.
Seems powerful. Any limitations?
Oh, definitely. Standard GRCH models usually predict smooth, downward sloping, or upward sloping term structures. They often can't capture more complex shapes, like a hump in the middle.
And estimating the parameters, the numbers that go into the GRCH equation.
That can be tricky. Usually it's done with maximum likelihood estimation, MLE, but the source warns this can lead to retrospective curve fitting.
Meaning it fits the past data really well.
But doesn't necessarily predict the future any better. Plus, you typically need a lot of data, like over 1,000 observations to get stable estimates.
What if you don't have that much data?
Well, then practitioners might just sort of choose parameters that look right based on experience, which, as the source says, isn't much more rigorous than using EWMA. Parameter instability over time is also a known issue.
So GRCH is useful, captures some dynamics, but isn't a magic bullet.
Pretty much. And unlike BSM, which is more of a pricing framework, a volatility forecast has to be judged on how well it actually corresponds with the future. It needs to be accurate.
Okay, if point forecasts from GAR-CH are tricky, what's another approach? The source talks about volatility cones.
Right. Volatility cones are quite different. Instead of giving you one forecast number, A cone shows you the historical range of realized volatility over different measurement periods.
So from Microsoft's say, it would show the highest, lowest, and average 30-day volatility we've seen historically, the range for 60-day volatility, 90-day, and so on.
Exactly. Figure 4.3 and Table 4.1 illustrate this. It gives you a historical distribution, a context.
And how is that useful for trading?
Well, the argument is that you can compare the current implied volatility, what the options market is pricing in, to this historical cone.
Ah, so you can see if implied vol is, say, in the 90th percentile of its historical range.
Precisely. And the source suggests that making trading decisions based on that comparison, like selling implied vol when it's historically very high according to the cone, might be more robust than relying purely on a Garrisey forecast.
Why is that?
Because big volatility moves are often driven by news, which is hard for models like GRCH to predict. The cone gives you a sense of the plausible range based on history, which might be a better guide when thinking about unpredictable events.
Interesting. The source also touches on fundamental volatility forecasting, especially for commodities.
Yeah. For some assets, you can try to forecast volatility based on underlying supply-demand fundamentals, inventory levels, things like that. That's probably more suited for longer-term forecasts or relative value trades between commodities.
But it also warns about relying only on the past.
Absolutely. History doesn't always repeat, especially when unprecedented events happen. And there's another important point. Market makers might systematically price implied volatility a bit above where they truly expect realized volatility to be.
Why would they do that?
Well, partly as an insurance premium against unexpected blowups, they're often short volatility, and partly just to capture the bid-ask spread consistently over time. It builds a cushion.
The equation 4.18 connects this difference between expected actual volatility and implied volatility to things like skewness, kurtosis, and risk aversion.
Yes, it formalizes how the market's perception of tail risk and its general willingness to take risk influences that volatility risk premium, the gap between implied and expected realized volatility.
Yeah.
Table 4.2 gives an example calculation.
So the bottom line on forecasting is?
All trading involves some kind of prediction. And since volatility is more predictable than price, trying to explicitly forecast it, even with imperfect tools, is valuable for understanding your potential edge or lack thereof.
Okay, let's move into implied volatility itself and how it behaves. The VIX index gets introduced here as the main barometer.
Yeah, figure 5.5 shows the VIX chart. It's basically the market's consensus expectation of S&P 500 volatility over the next 30 days, derived from option prices, a key indicator.
But we trade options on individual stocks or other indices too. One strategy discussed is buying a straddle around earnings announcements. What's the idea there?
A straddle is buying both a call and a put at the same strike price. Around earnings, there's often a lot of uncertainty, right? The stock could move big, up or down.
So you buy the straddle hoping for a large move in either direction.
Exactly. You pay a premium, but if the stock moves enough to overcome that premium, you profit. Figure 5.9 shows this has been historically profitable on average, though not always. Plus, implied volatility itself often rises going into the announcement, which can also help the straddle's value.
What makes some stocks better for this earnings straddle play? The source looks at fundamentals.
Yeah, it analyzes things like P/E ratio, market cap. But interestingly, the biggest factor seems to be the dispersion of analyst earnings estimates.
Dispersion meaning disagreement among analysts.
Exactly. Figure 5.10 and Table 5.1 show that when analysts really disagree about what the earnings number will be, those long straddles tend to perform better. High dispersion implies high uncertainty, which often leads to bigger post-earnings moves or higher implied volatility.
And conversely, what about selling straddles around earnings? Table 5.2 links that to fundamentals, too.
Right. Selling the straddle profits if the stock doesn't move much. High analyst dispersion can sometimes benefit sellers, too, because it means the implied volatility, and thus the premium you collect, is often very inflated. If the actual move is less than feared, the seller wins.
Okay, then the discussion shifts to how implied volatility changes when the underlying stock price moves. These sticky strike and sticky delta rules.
Yeah, these are kind of rules of thumb some traders use. Sticky strike assumes implied volatility for a specific strike price stays the same, even if the stock moves. Sticky delta assumes the implied volatility for options with the same delta stays the same.
But the source says these are too simple and can lead to arbitrage.
Because the real world is more complex. Implied volatility surfaces shift in more nuanced ways. If the market prices options according to these simple rules when they don't actually hold, mispricings pop up that could theoretically be exploited.
This relates to the volatility smile shown in figure 5.12.
Exactly. The smile shows that implied volatility isn't constant across different strike prices. It's typically higher for options far out of the money, both puts and calls, compared to at-the-money options.
And while the overall level of volatility is key, the shape of this smile is also tradable.
Yes. Trading the smile or skew involves betting on changes in the relative pricing of out-of-the-money options versus at-the-money options. It's essentially trading market expectations about skewness and kurtosis, those tail risks again.
The source mentions customer demand influencing this.
Yeah.
Like lots of people buying puts for protection.
That's one theory. If there's persistent demand for downside protection puts, market makers who sell them have to hedge. And their hedging activity can push up the implied volatility of those downside strikes, contributing to the skew or smile.
There's a surprising finding about fitting a simple quadratic curve to implied variance across different strikes and expiries for QQQQ options. Table 5.3.
Yeah, it suggests that despite the complexity, there can be some underlying regularity or structure to the implied volatility surface that can be captured relatively simply, at least for some assets at some times.
But the overall message is, just looking at volatility isn't enough for accurate option pricing. We need skewness and kurtosis, too.
Definitely. But incorporating them directly into pricing models is hard. Jarrow and Rudd tried with a perturbed log-normal distribution, but dealing with time-varying parameters is a challenge.
So a more practical approach is working backward from market prices.
Right. You take the observed option prices in the market and try to find the implied skewness and kurtosis values that make your theoretical model prices match the market prices best. Figure 5.13 illustrates this minimization process.
But these higher moments, skewness and kurtosis, their effects are tangled up together, aren't they? Figure 5.16?
They are. Changing skewness also affects implied kurtosis and vice versa in the pricing. It's complex. And a practical issue is that sometimes these adjustments can lead to theoretically impossible negative option prices if you're not careful about imposing boundary conditions.
Finally, on dynamics, there's this idea that back month implied vols overreact to front month moves, referencing Stein's work from 1989.
Yes. The theory suggests longer dated implied volatility should react less than proportionally to changes in short term implied volatility. But empirical studies, including Stein's and more recent ones, often find that back months react too much.
So the market might be too focused on the short term noise when pricing longer term options.
That seems to be the implication. It suggests potential inefficiencies or maybe just reflects how market makers manage their overall book risk.
Okay, that's a lot on implied vol dynamics. Let's pivot to hedging. This seems absolutely critical.
Non-negotiable if you're trading options seriously, especially if you're selling them. The source starts with utility theory, basically, how people feel about risk and reward.
Figures 6.1 and 6.2 illustrate risk aversion. We like more money, but the extra happiness we get from each additional dollar diminishes.
Exactly. And equation 6.1 defines the Arrow-Pratt measure of absolute risk aversion. The exponential utility function is often used to model this mathematically. Equations 6.5 and 6.6 link this to the idea of an indifference wealth.
But, as the source points out, real traders aren't always perfectly rational or consistent in their risk tolerance, right? Behavioral finance comes in again.
Absolutely. People's risk appetite can change based on recent performance, mood, framing. It's messy.
So how does that affect hedging?
Well, the precise optimal hedge might theoretically depend on your exact utility function. But the good news is the general principle of optimal hedging, balancing the cost of executing the hedge against the risk reduction it provides, holds true regardless. And often the practical hedging strategy doesn't change that much for different reasonable utility functions.
A big part of that cost-benefit calculation is transaction costs.
Huge. You've got fixed costs per trade, commissions. But the bigger, more variable parts are the bid-ask spread you cross and market impact, how your own trading moves the price against you, especially for larger trades.
Table 6.2 and figure 6.9 show market depth, how much liquidity there is at different price levels. This matters for market impact.
Definitely. If you need to hedge a large delta quickly in a thin market, you're going to feel the impact. So a key insight for positional traders who might build up larger positions over time is you have to factor in potential hedging costs and market impact.
Okay, so how do you actually hedge in practice? The source mentions different strategies, Hodges-Neuberger.
HN is the theoretical ideal. It tells you exactly when to hedge based on minimizing costs for a given level of risk under certain assumptions. But it requires continuous monitoring and trading, which is impossible in reality.
So more practical options. Wally Wilmot.
WW is a very useful approximation. It sets up hedging bands around your target delta. You only rehedge when your position's delta drifts outside these bands. Equations 6.7, 6.9 define it, and figures 6.3, 6.5 show the bands.
And this is something you could implement on standard platforms?
Yes, it's much more practical. It reduces the frequency of trading compared to trying to constantly stay perfectly delta neutral.
Mm-hmm.
For many positional traders, this is probably the right balance.
Then there's Zekemelin.
Zekemelin's strategy is presented as a more sophisticated approximation to the optimal HN strategy, potentially offering better risk-cost trade-offs than WW, but it's also more complex mathematically to implement. Equations 6.13 and 6.15 and figures 6.6 and 6.7 give the details.
So it's a spectrum, theoretical perfection versus ease of implementation.
Pretty much. And the core goal always is that hedging is about removing directional risk from your options position, not about adding new bets on where the underlying is going next.
The source also offers a simple model for estimating market impact costs using Poisson processes and square root of trade size. Equations 6.16, TAC 6.22, and figure 6.0.
Yeah, that's quite neat. It tries to give an intuitive feel for how impact costs scale with trade size without needing super granular transaction data. Useful for ballpark estimates.
So, key hedging takeaway. Find a practical strategy that balances cost and risk reduction. Be aware of transaction costs, and remember, you're hedging, not speculating.
Couldn't say it better. Now, related to this is the fact that we don't hedge continuously. We hedge discreetly. What are the consequences?
Path dependency, right. The source gives an example. Buy a call, delta hedge it daily, run simulation.
Exactly. And what happens? The average profit loss across many simulations might be close to zero, maybe slightly negative due to costs. But the dispersion, the range of outcomes in individual simulations, is huge. Because the Black-Scholes argument relies on being able to replicate the option perfectly by continuously trading the underlying. Since we only trade intermittently, example daily, the specific path the stock price takes between our hedges matters a lot. Did it wiggle around a lot? Did it gap? That introduces tracking error.
Figure 7.1 shows this dispersion visually for replicating a long call. So if you hedge less frequently, say weekly instead of daily, this path-dependent error gets even bigger.
Absolutely. The less frequently you hedge, the more randomness or volatility you introduce into your hedging P&L. Equations 7.5, 7.7 give some approximations for the variance of this discrete hedging error, and figure 7.6 shows how it generally decreases as you hedge more often.
Okay, now what volatility should you use when you hedge? The source says maybe not the actual expected realized volatility, table 7.3.
This is subtle. The optimal volatility to plug into your model for calculating hedge ratios might actually be slightly biased away from your true forecast. The optimal bias depends on whether you're long or short gamma, option sensitivity to volatility changes, and maybe your view on market direction.
So it's not just about matching expected
volatility. Well, not necessarily for minimizing hedging error or replication cost? No.
This connects to break-even volatility skews, equation 7.14.
Yes. This concept highlights that the level of implied volatility at which your delta-hedged option position breaks even, makes zero P&L, actually depends on the option's gamma.
So fair implied volatility isn't one single number. It depends on the specific option's characteristics.
Exactly. A high gamma option might break even at a different implied volatility than a low gamma option, even if realized volatility turns out the same. This affects both long and short gamma positions.
Lastly, on hedging, there's the effect of many options expiring right at the strike price, pin risk.
Right. When lots of options are clustered around a strike near expiration, the hedging activity of market makers trying to stay delta neutral can actually suppress or pin the underlying price near that strike, potentially reducing realized volatility just when option holders might want it. Figure 7.9 illustrates this.
Okay, that covers hedging complexities. What about deciding how much to trade? Trade sizing.
Crucial topic. Get this wrong, and even a winning strategy can bankrupt you. The source introduces the Kelly criterion.
Ah, Kelly. Famous, maybe infamous. What's the core idea? Equation 8.2.
Kelly aims to find the optimal fraction of your capital to bet on a positive expected value trade in order to maximize the long-term geometric growth rate of your wealth. It's about maximizing the expected logarithm of wealth, equation 8.11.
Not just maximizing expected profit on the next trade, but long-term compounding.
Exactly. Equation 8.14 gives a simplified version for small edges. The fraction to bet depends on your edge, expected return over risk-free, divided by the variance of the outcome.
Table 8.1 is interesting. It shows the probability of doubling your money before having it based on what fraction of the full Kelly bet you use.
Yeah, it highlights the trade-off. Full Kelly gives the fastest growth on average, but the ride can be incredibly volatile. Using a fraction of Kelly, half Kelly, quarter Kelly, smooths the ride considerably but slows down the long-term growth.
So, a key insight. Full Kelly maximizes long-term growth but comes with potentially terrifying drawdowns. Most people should probably use a fraction.
That's generally the advice, yes. Kelly has different interpretations, maximizing growth, or even as a sort of poor man's Bayesian approach where your bet size reflects your confidence. Chapman's work shows how the probability distribution of your bankroll spreads out over time under Kelly.
And a critical point in the Kelly framework, going broke, losing everything, is infinitely bad. You never bet so much that ruin is possible on a single outcome.
Right, which again argues for fractional Kelly. Also, you need to think about whether Kelly applies to your entire net worth or just your active trading capital. The fraction should adjust accordingly.
Are there situations where Kelly might be more acceptable?
The source suggests maybe for personal accounts where the owner understands and accepts the volatility, or perhaps in very high-frequency trading where edges are small and decay quickly, maximizing growth might be paramount.
But in institutional settings, maybe not.
Often not. Institutions might have different objectives. Steady returns, low drawdowns, short-term performance targets that don't align perfectly with maximizing long-term geometric growth a la Kelly, agency issues come into play.
What about alternatives? Oscar system.
Oscar system, table 8.2, is mentioned as a progressive system aiming for small, consistent wins. But it involves increasing bet size after losses, which is generally considered much riskier than Kelly.
And Brown's dynamic strategy.
That's different again. It focuses on maximizing the probability of reaching a specific wealth target within a given time frame, rather than maximizing the growth rate. The optimal strategy depends on the target and time horizon. Equation 8.44, figures 8.44, 8.15.
A big warning, though. Kelly and similar strategies are very sensitive to assumptions about the return distribution, especially fat tails.
Hugely sensitive. Figures 8.16 and 8.16 show how much worse Kelly performs if returns have fatter tails, more extreme events than assumed. If you underestimate tail risk, Kelly can lead you to bet way too much.
Finally, a brief mention of using Bollinger Bands for sizing trades in mean reverting products like VIX.
Yeah, sizing bets based on how far the price has deviated from its moving average, fading the extremes.
Okay, so sizing is complex, Kelly is powerful but dangerous, and understanding distributions is key. What about evaluating trades after they're done?
Post-trade analysis, absolutely vital for learning and improving. The source stresses this and provides an example list of useful statistics. Table 9.1.
Things like total P&L, daily P&L stats, max profit loss, win-loss rates, average wins losses, drawdowns. Figure 9.3 shows drawdowns. Why track all this?
Because it gives you objective feedback. It helps you see if your strategy is actually performing as expected over time. Is the edge degrading? Is your execution slipping? Are you drifting into trades you didn't intend to take? Style drift.
So it combats the tendency to just remember the wins or rely on gut feel.
Exactly. Gut feel can be misleading. Hard numbers tell the real story. Setting explicit trading goals based on these statistics is also important.
The source cautions against using haircut as a risk measure.
Yeah, a haircut usually refers to the margin requirement. It's an operational constraint, not necessarily a good measure of the actual economic risk of the position. Also, defining the account size denominator for calculating percentage returns needs care.
Then we get into various risk-adjusted performance metrics, going beyond just total profit. Sharpe ratio is the classic one.
Right. Sharpe ratio, equation 9.2, measures excess return per unit of total volatility, standard deviation.
But what if you only care about downside volatility?
Then you might look at the Sortino ratio, equation 9.3, which uses downside deviation instead of standard deviation in the denominator.
And others, Kalmar, Sterling, omega K ratio.
Yeah, Kalmar, equation 9.4, relates return to maximum drawdown. Sterling is similar, but uses average drawdown over a period. Omega equations 9.5, 9.6 looks at the probability weighted ratio of gains over losses relative to a target return. K ratio equation 9.7 uses linear regression of cumulative returns over time.
So lots of different ways to slice and dice performance. What's the takeaway?
No single number is perfect. Each ratio highlights different aspects of the risk return profile. It's best to look at several of them to get a rounded picture.
And be aware that people can game these metrics.
Oh, yeah. If a manager knows they're being judged solely on Sharpe ratio, they might alter their strategy to optimize that metric, even if it's not truly the best strategy overall. Independent checks are good.
The source also advises setting clear P&L targets or stop losses up front, figure 9.8, to avoid constantly tinkering with trades based on noise.
Yes, define your exit conditions beforehand. and resist the urge to drastically increase or decrease trade size based only on very recent results, unless you have strong evidence that something fundamental about your edge or the market has changed.
There's also relative persistence for evaluating managers.
Yeah, equations 9.7, 9.8, table 9.2. That's a metric trying to assess if a manager's recent performance is likely to continue, useful for capital allocators.
Finally, why might a strategy that used to work stop working?
Several reasons. Maybe the initial success was just luck. The market environment changed, your execution got worse, the counterparties you trade against got smarter. It happens.
So the advice is to compare what you're doing now to what you did when it was working and maybe get a second opinion if you're stuck in a losing streak.
Good advice. Now let's talk psychology. This might be the most important part.
The source argues that a lot of the edge in volatility trading might actually come from exploiting other people's psychological biases.
That's a strong theme, yes. Because volatility pricing often seems to reflect fear, greed, and cognitive errors more than pure rational calculation. The cognitive reflection test questions are given as examples of how easily our intuition trips us up on seemingly simple problems.
Okay, let's run through some common biases mentioned. Self-attribution bias.
That's taking personal credit for successes. I'm a genius. But blaming external factors for failures. The market was irrational. Easier to spot in others than yourself, apparently. Might decrease with experience, hopefully.
Overconfidence.
Believing your skills or knowledge are better than they actually are. Confidence should follow demonstrated skill, not precede it. Cramer's stock picks are used as a cautionary example of confident predictions not always panning out.
Short-term thinking.
Yeah, the lure of immediate gratification. Preferring small, quick wins over potentially larger but slower, more uncertain long-term gains. Taleb links this to the appeal of short gamma positions collecting premium now, ignoring the potential blow-up risk later.
Loss aversion.
This is huge. Feeling the pain of a loss much more strongly than the pleasure of an equivalent gain leads people to hold on to losing trades too long, hoping they'll come back, rather than cutting losses. Affects everyone, even successful people.
Conservatism and representativeness.
Conservatism is being too slow to update your beliefs when new information comes in under reaction, which can lead to momentum effects. Representativeness is clinging to initial stereotypes or views, even when evidence contradicts them.
Confirmation bias.
Actively seeking out information that confirms your existing beliefs and ignoring or downplaying evidence that challenges them. Super common. The source stresses the importance of actively trying to disprove your own trading ideas.
Hindsight bias.
The I knew it all along effect. After an event happens, thinking it was much more predictable than it actually was beforehand. Good record keeping and making falsifiable forecasts helps combat this.
Anchoring.
Over-relying on the first piece of information you receive, like deciding where you want to sell an option before checking the current implied volatility levels. The study on volatility around 52-week high slows is an example of potential anchoring effects in the market.
And the narrative fallacy.
Our tendency to prefer compelling stories over cold, hard statistics. Buying far out of the money options because of a scary crash narrative, even if the statistical odds are terrible. The Bartman incident is mentioned as an example of finding narratives for random events.
Wow, that's a minefield of potential errors. The key insight seems to be, know thyself. Be aware of these biases existing you and others.
Absolutely. Self-awareness is probably the first step to mitigating their impact.
Okay, let's switch back to strategies. How do we actually generate returns using volatility?
Well, the most fundamental source is the volatility risk premium we talked about earlier. Figure 11.1 visually compares VIX, implied vol, to subsequent realized volatility, often showing that implied is higher.
So selling that premium.
That's the core idea behind many strategies. Selling variance swaps explicitly captures this difference, equation 11.1. Gamma scalping, selling options, and then delta hedging frequently also aims to profit if realized vol is lower than the implied vol you sold the option at.
Volatility arbitrage.
Exploiting apparent mispricings between related volatility products or options. And selling event risk selling options around earnings or other binary events where the implied vol might be overly inflated.
Why does this premium exist? Risk aversion.
That's a big part of it. People demand a premium for selling insurance against volatility spikes. Uncertainty plays a role. And crucially, losses on short volatility positions often happen at the same time as losses in the broader equity market, making it particularly painful and thus requiring a higher premium.
What about the other side, buying options? Why isn't that premium competed away entirely?
Well, there are natural sellers. Stockholders might sell covered calls against their shares to generate income. And some theories suggest investors, especially institutional ones due to agency effects, might actually prefer assets with negative skewness, lottery ticket potential, which could depress option prices somewhat.
Okay, let's talk about model-free volatility.
Right. Instead of relying on a model like Black-Scholes, you can calculate implied variance, and thus volatility, directly from a strip of option prices across different strikes. Equations 12.1 and 12.2 show the formula.
It's model-free because it doesn't assume log-normal returns.
Exactly. Though there's a slight technical issue. Taking the square root to get volatility introduces a slight upward bias due to Jensen's inequality.
And the VIX index is the prime example of this.
Yes. The VIX calculation uses a wide range of S&P 500 option prices to arrive at a model-independent forward-looking measure of expected 30-day volatility. Demeter Phi and colleagues worked out the practical discrete approximation.
And you can trade products based on the VIX, futures, ETFs like VXX, VXZ.
Yes, there's a whole ecosystem now. The source gives examples of VIX trading strategies, like systematically shorting VXX, though with huge caveats about risk, or using calendar spreads on VIX options. It mentions the historically high Sharpe ratios, but also the severe potential drawdowns.
This ties back to the VIX variance premium, the tendency for VIX futures to price in higher volatility than what often realizes.
Precisely. Strategies like shorting VIX straddles or strangles or buying put spreads on VIX aim to harvest this premium, as discussed in the cited papers by Barney and Hogan.
Okay, one more specific product type, leveraged ETFs.
Ah, yes, the double or triple leverage funds. The source explains their mechanics. They aim to deliver a multiple of the daily return of an index.
And the key issue is the compounding effect, the volatility drag.
Exactly. Because they reset daily, the compounding over longer periods means their performance can significantly deviate from just the multiple of the index's return, especially in volatile, choppy markets. This drag hurts performance over time.
The source notes they behave like perpetual power options.
Mathematically, yes. And it provides a framework, equations 13.1, 13.1, and figure 13.1, for how to think about options on these leveraged ETFs compared to options on the underlying index itself by considering the volatility drag effect on the expected terminal price.
So be very careful with leveraged ETFs and options on them.
Definitely. Understand the path dependency and volatility drag.
Okay, let's wrap things up by walking through the life cycle of a trade example given in the source trading Apple AAPL options around earnings.
Right. This pulls together many of the concepts. It starts with the pre-trade process.
Identifying the catalyst, the upcoming earnings announcement. Then measuring historical volatility using different estimators like Parkinson, Garmin Class, Rogers Satchel, figures 14.2, 14.4, and noting the current implied volatility.
Then execution. Mm-hmm. In this example, selling some call options, implicitly betting that the post-earnings move won't be as large as the high implied volatility suggests, or that implied vol will fall after the event.
Then hedging. The example involves delta hedging the short calls to reduce directional risk.
Monitoring is next. Watching the ADPL stock price, but also, crucially, watching what happens to the implied volatility of the options themselves after the earnings are released.
And the exit. In this case, they didn't hold until expiration.
No. They exited early because the implied volatility dropped significantly after the earnings news, vol crush, even though stock price hadn't moved dramatically against them yet. They locked in the profit from the vol collapse.
Holding longer could have been worse if the stock then moved adversely.
Potentially, yes. It highlights that the exit decision depends on your original thesis and how the market evolves. The profit came mainly from the vol drop here.
Finally, post-trade analysis. What went right? Identifying the catalyst, getting the timing right on the exit by focusing on the implied vol change. What could have gone wrong? A much bigger stock move, vol not collapsing as much.
And the importance of reevaluating the position based on new information, not just getting stopped out automatically by a price move if the original volatility thesis might still be valid.
That's a great practical illustration. So, final thoughts from the source material.
It really emphasizes that success isn't just about technical knowledge. Understanding the models, volatility dynamics, hedging, sizing, psychology, that's all necessary, but not sufficient.
A model isn't a strategy, and a strategy isn't a business.
Well put. You need a repeatable process, risk management, good infrastructure. Choosing the right products to trade is also critical. Where do the inefficiencies actually lie?
And the goal is ultimately to make money, not just to be theoretically clever or the best trader.
Right. Even mundane things matter. Software, hardware, data feeds, daily routines, and continuous learning. Knowledge itself is an edge, and the market keeps evolving.
So to sum up our deep dive, we've journeyed through volatility measurement, forecasting, the fascinating dynamics of implied vol, the practicalities of hedging, the dangers of trade sizing, the huge impact of psychology.
It looked at specific ways to generate returns, from the vol risk premium to VIX products, and even leveraged ETFs, wrapping up with a concrete trade example.
Hopefully, synthesizing these insights from the diverse source materials gives you, the listener, a significant advantage in navigating this complex but potentially rewarding area of volatility trading.
And as the source material suggests, digging deeper into the cited academic work can provide even more nuanced understanding.
So we'll leave you with a final thought to ponder. In this ever-changing market landscape, how do you, as a trader, strike the right balance? How do you best integrate the quantitative rigor of models and data with that crucial awareness of the psychological biases that constantly influence your own decisions and the behavior of the market itself?